Okay, it is July 27th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm talking with Robert Sullivan, who's the longtime dean of the law school at the University of Montana.
I've tried to compress in a short time, the 25 years. I can't believe I was there that long. But in looking at it, it seems to me that there are several phases or components, okay? For example, the beginnings. It was authorized by the Board of Education in 1911. And at that time, the Supreme Court of Montana, without any insistence by the law school, by the university at all, they issued an order to encourage people who graduated from the law school here to stay in Montana and practice law. And that order has been referred to as the Diploma Privilege, which is a bad explanation, but a bad term. And so under the Diploma Privilege, the law school certified graduates for the practice of law, and the Supreme Court swore them in. So we were the admitting authority, you see, and that's a hell of a responsibility. So that was just there. That was a part of the law school creation. And nobody paid much attention to it, you know. It was just pro forma, you know. The law faculty would meet after all of the grades were in the senior year, and they would recommend the Supreme Court that these people be admitted. And the Attorney General of the state would get up there and present to the court and move their admission, and that was it, okay. Now, it came to be quite an issue some years after I was here. A Montanan who had gone to Yale Law School brought a suit alleging that this was discriminatory, and that here he was a Yale graduate, and here he had to take the bar examination when all of these non-Yale graduates had a free ride, so to speak. Lots of litigation on that point, all the way to the United States Supreme Court on one occasion, and uniformly the court said, this is not discrimination, this is laudable objective and so forth. Now, in my years here, I was very active with the Bar Association. I was admitted to practice in Montana by examination after 2 years of law school at Notre Dame. I was called to the service, and so they gave a special bar examination for two ROTC people here. And my dad heard about it, and so I took it, and the three of us passed, and each with 2 years of law school. Nine others who had taken a previous day didn't make it. So I am familiar with the bar examination and all of this stuff. And I was active in the movement where the Supreme Court changed the voluntary bar to a unified bar, which meant that every lawyer practicing in Montana was a member of the Bar Association, whether he wanted to be or not, you know. And so, and that happened in 1975. That's just by way of an aside.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me we might, I'll listen to your general questions, and we'll go into that. So it seems to me that there were the beginnings, okay? And then it seems to me that there was a transition to a graduate professional school. And then it seems to me that the law school, with its involvement with the legislature and the Supreme Court, Bar Association, others, become a kind of a legal center for the state. Now, it didn't mean that we were abdicating our primary responsibility, but we were very active in the legislature. There's an organization formed in 1882 called the Uniform Laws Conference. And the Chief Justice of the Montana Supreme Court and Alex Blewett, a lawyer, legislator from Great Falls, and I were appointed commissioners in 1957. And we were very active in getting those uniform laws passed in Montana. So a part of the outreach, and I'm not talking about Bob Sullivan, I'm talking about the vehicle of the Uniform Laws Conference and these three individuals who had these uniform laws, worked with the legislators, you know, and Bar Association interested parties in getting uniform laws passed. At one time, we ranked number one in the United States in terms of the total number of uniform laws passed. I've been retired from that for a while, so I'm not actively involved in the operation anymore. So what I'm saying is that a lot of the things in this legal center concept flowed from the expertise of the law faculty, flowed from their involvement as faculty members, in emerging and growth of the law and so forth. An exciting time, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pleased to be able to try to fill in some of the blanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the first blank I'd like you to fill in, and you know, you're talking about very broad things about law in general and the university's law school place in that historically, is just your own personal and educational background and how you came to the University of Montana and law school.
I was born and raised in Helena, Montana. Graduated Catholic high school and Catholic grade school there. Then I took my college in law at Notre Dame. I played football there. I played a lot of football there. But anyway, I was on the traveling squad in 1938. We played both ways, you know. And there were only three teams, plus three others. Well, I was the third team right guard in my sophomore year. And then the following year in spring practice, I was the first team, right guard. But I got hurt, and that was the end of my playing days. But then I was able to get a graduate assistantship to help coach the freshman football team. And that enabled me to go to Notre Dame Law School. Well, I went there 2 years, and then I got called to the service. Came back in service, went to Notre Dame, back to Notre Dame on a GI Bill, got my law degree. Practiced law in Ohio briefly, and then I got an invitation to go to Notre Dame to teach in the law school. Well, I did. I taught there for 7 years and developed a background in oil and gas law and wrote a book that Prentice Hall published. And so a man that helped me get into Notre Dame, I knew Carl McFarland very, very well. In fact, he worked for Carl McFarland in the Department of Justice when Carl was an assistant attorney general. He called me one day when I was in Notre Dame. He said, Carl McFarland is here. He's looking for a dean of the law school and a professor of oil and gas law. And I've told him about you and he wants to meet you. So I went from South Bend up to Chicago and met Carl, and he asked me to come out to Montana. And I came out and was interviewed by a committee of the university faculty and some lawyers. He offered me the job. Well, my roots in Notre Dame were very, very deep. I was in law school 7 years. Pardon me, my wife and I were married at the Log Chapel. Several of our children were born in South Bend. But I was encouraged by the Academy of Vice President of Notre Dame to come out to Montana. He said, you can probably do more for your profession and your faith in a public law school than you could if you stayed at Notre Dame. Go try it for a year. If you don't like it, come back. Well, we came for 1 year and it turned into 25. So that's how I happened to come. My experience at Notre Dame, I taught a lot of courses. But I never thought I'd be a teacher, you know. And so when the time came to teach, I relied upon my professors who were still there, who monitored me and assisted me. And I hadn't practiced long enough to really know what practice law was like. And so I started to experiment a little bit. And studied law prior to World War II. Was through the vehicle of decided cases. And professors would develop what they called case books. They might find a case that would illustrate that there has to be an offer and an acceptance for there to be a valid contract, okay? And so they'd find this case. Well, hell, the case may have points on procedure and evidence and everything else, you know? And so they would digest the factual situation just as it related to offer and acceptance and contract and put that in a case book. And so so there were case books for particular subjects, you know, like property, corporation, and so forth. Wound up teaching property, which is a very difficult course to teach. It goes back to the common law of England, you know, and so forth. And so and the case book was a great case book, a man by the name of Agler, a professor at the University of Michigan. But in some instances of the law pursuing property, there were concepts it would take a month of discussing different cases to get the wholeness of the concept. And so what I did, I thought, you know, I drafted a property problem. And I put all of these things in the problem, and then I gave the students the problem with a few citations to cases or a treatise. And so we'd come into class, and I'd say, "Well, you know, what about this?" You know, well, somebody had. They'd talk about this and that. I found that in two class sessions, I could get laid out every complex part of that concept. You can see the whole of it, you see, without concentrating just on maybe what was the intent and so forth. Am I making any sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started using what I call the problem approach. And I use that throughout the property course. And so when I came out to Montana, I'd written this book that Prentisol had published, and one of the courses I taught here was oil and gas law. And so I used the problem approach. And it was a senior level course, and so I'd hand out these problems. And I say, well, now, what? And we talk about property, we talk about ownership, okay? Well, oil and gas was discovered as a byproduct of drilling for salt back in Pennsylvania in the mid-1850s, okay? And they saw this damn gooey stuff and it just polluted everything. Well, the thing that happened was that here was a stream running through this big tract of land, and there were different owners, you know, bordering the stream. And this one fellow that drilled the well and got the oil in it, they found out, well, hell, they've been using whale oil, you know, and here was this stuff that would be more economical. And so this one fella, he'd say, here's the dividing line. A is here and B is here. So A drilled a well right near the boundary line. Thank God he found a well. You know, didn't go down very far. And so they were both farmers. And they both knew that in the subsurface that water moves, you know, called percolating waters, okay? And so this guy here says, you know, part of that oil is probably mine, you know. I mean, sucked out over the boundary line. So he sued. And the court says, well, who owns it? Or what is it? Well, there are things called in the we characterize things as being animal, vegetable, or mineral. Well, it's not an animal, it's not a vegetable, must be a mineral, you know? But it's a peculiar kind of mineral that the kind of moves. It's not like coal or copper. And so there had been a case decided in England many, many years ago about percolating waters. And the court decided that the person who reduced it to possession became the owner. It was called the rule of capture. And so the American court applied the rule of capture to oil, you know. Well, you know what happened. And this bee said, what am I going to do? They said, well, go ahead and drill a well of your own. So if this well is over here, there'd be another one here, like this. So anyway, I would, in that senior class, I'd say, well, now, what is, what is this thing? You know, how does it fit into the classification of rights that can be owned, whether they're owning land or the right to walk across land, like an easement? And so I kind of needed them because this was a basic first-year property course that they'd already had 2 years before. And couldn't figure out what it was. And finally I said, well, you know, it's It's a substance, really. With that substance, there's the right to take it, okay? Now, that right to take can be divided, you know. Somebody who owns the surface can sell the minerals, you know, either solid minerals or oil or gas. And so I said, well, now this is what in the law of property they call an incorporeal hereditament. Oh, God. Well, that means that it tells what it is not. It's not an easement, you know, but it's the right to take, okay? Well, one of the students told me years later that he was with a bunch of lawyers up in Canada, and they were involved in a huge complex a sale of oil and gas rights. And after they had put the whole thing together, they were having a martini and they were kind of talking. And he said, you know, there are lawyers there from Yale and Harvard and all over the place. And somebody said, well, now, what is this? You know, what is this right to take that we've kind of carved up? And C.J. Hansen, now dead, God love him, he said, well, he said, that is an incorporeal hereditament. He said, where the hell did you hear that, you know? But as they talked about it, you know, that's what it was. So what I'm saying is that I found teaching was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Although I intended to be a lawyer, you know. I never got around doing that for 25 years later. But, so that's how I happened to come to Montana. Mm-hmm. And when I came, there were 6 faculty members, full-time and 2 part-time. Now, as we grew over the years, we got to the point, you know, where we limited the first-year class to 75, total of 225. They're still doing that. Because we didn't have the facilities of the faculty. Well, the faculty had grown from 6 full-time to 17 full-time, and from 2 part-time to 3 part-time, and a student body of 225. So that's how I happened to come to Montana.
Mm-hmm. So before we started taping here, you were telling me a sort of personal story about your relationship with Carl McFarland and
okay. How
you were actually hired. I wondered if you could retell that, as well as, you know, you've talked a little bit about your teaching and some of the methodology of your teaching,
yeah,
and how you change things. Talk a little bit about, I guess, just relationships on campus when you first came here, as maybe in comparison to your experience at Notre Dame.
Have we been taping it all?
We have been.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Between both you and other law faculty, as well as law faculty and the rest of the school.
Yeah. Well, you want me to tell you a little bit of how I came to Montana?
Mm-hmm. I'd particularly like to rehear the story about your relationship with Carl McFarland and being hired.
Okay, right. Well, I've told this in the thing I'd done with Duke Riley at the law school. I think I better tell you it as well, but I want to put a lid on it, on this particular part of it. I was born and raised in Helena, Montana. And I went through grade school and high school there. And then my grandmother, God rest her soul, born in Ireland, died and left me money. And my dad said, how would you like to go to Notre Dame? Well, there's a learned and graduate in hell out by the name of Bill Jones. And he helped me get in. And I went back there, and I had already started college at Carroll College in Helena, but I was in the National Guard, and they had a huge earthquake in Helena in 1935, and they mobilized us to be auxiliary police at night. Well, after being up all night for 3 weeks and falling asleep in class during the daytime, I just dropped out of school. I had an uncle that was a gold miner over in Marysville, so I went and worked for him. And then I lived with my grandmother and her three bachelor sons. And then I went back to Notre Dame the following year. I majored in criminology. And then I thought, now what the hell am I going to do with that, you know? So I wrote to Bill Jones. I said, can I come to Washington, get a job with the government, and go to law school at Georgetown? He said, oh yeah, you can come. He said, I'll help you. But he said, why don't you go talk to your football coach, Elmer Leyden, who is one of the four horsemen, and see if you can't be appointed a graduate assistant to help coach the freshman football team. Well, I did, and I got the job. Partially, I think, because I was injured my senior year and didn't play very much. So, first year, well, Leyden's contract was not renewed. They brought in Frank Leahy from Boston College. He only had four coaches. Leahy, the head coach, McKeever, the backfield coach, Johnny Drew, the end coach, Joe McCarter, the line coach. So he dragged another graduate assistant and I from the law school, and we helped coach the Notre Dame football team during spring practice. And then he brought us back in the early fall, and we coached there. But then I had a low draft number in World War II, and I was deferred before Pearl Harbor, and if I could have stayed at Notre Dame a fifth semester, I could have got my law degree, because they had a rule that if you were there five semesters and were called, they'd give you a law degree. Well, I wasn't deferred. So I went in the service and came back and went to Notre Dame on a GI Bill, got my law degree, practiced law in Ohio briefly, and then was invited to come back and teach at Notre Dame. So I went back not knowing what a law teacher does, and depended upon my teachers who were, some were still there. I didn't know what the practice of law really was either, but I had some ideas that I used in teaching at Notre Dame that I found helped me a lot and helped the law students a lot. And that's, and then when I was at Notre Dame, they gave me a stipend each of 2 summers to go down to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and learn something about the oil and gas industry, because they wanted to teach a course in oil and gas law at Notre Dame. And that's how I happened to do that. Well, when I was, and then I got an invitation to go to Bismarck, North Dakota, to join a law firm. They discovered a oil in North Dakota, Tioga, and nobody knew anything about oil and gas. And so I didn't want to live in North Dakota, but I went out there as a consultant. And that's where I got the idea about writing this oil and gas book. Well, Prentice Hall published it, and I was just winding up all the details of it when I got a call from Bill Jones. He said, Carl McFarland is here, looking for a dean of the law school and a professor of oil and gas law. He's the president of Montana State University. I've told him about you, he wants to meet you. So I went up to Chicago, met Carl as he had a stopover on the train. He invited me to come out to Missoula, Dean Liepart had retired, and they were looking for someone to be dean of the law school. I came out, was interviewed, and he offered me the job, but he said, you know, he said, you're an associate professor of law at Notre Dame. I can't bring you out as professor of law at Montana and dean of the law school. But he said, I'm a lawyer, and he said, I teach a course in the law school. He said, so what I'll do, I'll be dean of the law school. You will be the assistant dean. You will do all the work. And he said, within 3 years' time, you'll be dean of the law school. Well, I came out in August of 54, and I was named dean in April of 55 on recommendation of Carl McFarland. Now, Carl was a graduate of the University of Montana Law School. And he worked in Main Hall in the president's office while he was in school. So he knew a lot about the university. And when he graduated, he practiced briefly in Helena and then went to Harvard and got his SJD degree, which is the pinnacle of degrees in law, like a PhD. For his thesis, he chose the topic of the use of administrative agencies in the operation of government. Well, it was a bestseller in a sense. It was printed in the American Bar Journal, and he got the Ross Prize, still at age 30, you know, in his 30s, which is for the most prestigious article in the journal during that year. Homer Cummings, the Attorney General under Roosevelt, hired him. And so what Carl did, he was the artisan of the Federal Administrative Procedure Act. And he later wrote a book and was with the government for quite a while. Then he left, practiced law in Washington, and had a couple of big Indian cases. Well, then, John Bonner, the governor of Montana, knew Carl. And Bonner was the Board of Education consisted of the governor, superintendent of public instruction, attorney general, and 7 appointed members. Well, Bonner hired Carl to be president of the University of Montana without asking anybody else. Well, that didn't sit very well. But he came, and he'd been here about 3 years or more when I was here, when he offered the job to me. And as is the case with many people, scholars, researchers, and others, he developed a capacity of such intense concentration sometimes that you're just oblivious to everything around you, you know. Well, that was one of Carl's attributes. And he didn't have what they would call the social graces, you know, of this diverse group on the State Board of Reason, or State Board of Education. And so there was a president of MSU by the name of Ronald Rennie, and he was a great president, and he was very aggressive, and in those years there wasn't any Board of Regents, and what the practice was that each president presented their own, their budget to the Board of Education, which would approve, and then they would have to go to the legislature, the president, and sell the budget. So there's a lot of jockeying back and forth between Rennie and McFarland. Rennie came in one time and got authorization for a PhD in chemistry. Well, sometime later, Carl King came in with a PhD in chemistry. Duplication. No. MSU, that's industrially oriented. People are going on. At U of M, that's research oriented. You know? So, now, so I think that Carl was kind of uneasy. Pardon me. Some of the board were uneasy with Carl because he kept his cards pretty close to the chest, you know. And I came in 54, and Bob Panser was hired by Carl a couple of years after that to be the chief finance officer. He had been president of the Alumni Association, practiced law in Livingston. Well, anyway, Carl put his budget together for this 1 year. Well, let me back up a minute. Carl was a brilliant person. And this was a good university. But he wanted to make it a great university. Now, there had been a time many years previously where a president got in some difficulty with the faculty, I guess, and the law people in town got involved, and it was just a real, real mess. And he wound up getting fired, I think. And so there had been a tradition here, you know, that these are my words, that the faculty wanted the authority, but they didn't want the responsibility, you know? And so there were all kinds of committees, and there was a committee on grounds, for example, and a committee on landscaping, you know? Well, the building we were in had originally been the library. And then it's the one with the big, on the oval with the big pillars, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was finally, and the law school was kind of itinerant. It had different locations. But in 1954, the Alumni Association moved out of the basement, and so the law school had that whole building. Now, one summer, we returned to campus, and I think it was, I think I was here at the time. But there was a road, you know, that you come up University Avenue, and you could drive on the campus, and there was a dirt road that circled the oval. So you could drive up and drive up in front of Main Hall and park or drop somebody off or pick somebody up and then go on out again. Well, to the consternation of townspeople and alumni and everybody else, during the summer, Carl had closed the road. And then there was a brick building that is no longer in existence. There was a mini observatory. It was also used by the Associated Women of the University of Montana. Well, he got rid of the road leading to that. Not in the same year, but I think the next year, he also closed the road on from Van Buren, from the bridge, all the way to the heart of the campus. And then, in front of the law building, he took out some bushes. Well, everybody was just mad as hell at him, you know. and ask him where did he get that authority and so forth. So he was not popular in the eyes of many people on the campus. There was plotting about how they could get rid of him, you know, and so forth. And in 1958, Carl McFarland brought me in here, and I think that people kind of looked askance at me because he brought me in here, you know. And the interesting thing was that on the law faculty, there is a man by the name of David Mason who taught here, my God, 25 years or more. He had his SJD degree from Harvard, a great teacher. And when Dean Leapart retired, there was great expectation that David Mason would be named the dean. Well, Carl had other ideas. He wanted to bring somebody from the outside and interviewed widely, I'm sure. So when I came here as dean, I was a wolf in the hen's nest, you know. I had people tell me that they'd never met me, but they didn't like me, you know. And people would say to David Mason, you should have been the dean, you know. Well, the dean of the New York University Law School in New York City was a grad, Russell Niles was the graduate of the University of Montana. And he asked Carl, or he asked David to come back and teach there for a year. Well, David was teaching, among other, teaching some of the business courses, bills and notes, sales, things of this kind. And the Uniform Laws Conference had promulgated, oh, back in 1952, I think, a thing called the Uniform Commercial Code that took about six different acts and welded them together. And got passed in Pennsylvania, because that was the only state that passed it, because a man by the name of Schneider, who was a Uniform Laws Commissioner and was on the drafting committee, he was from Pennsylvania, and so he got it ramrodded through. But there had been a casebook, you know, using that. And David was using the casebook on the Uniform Commercial Code. This is a great law school, and they didn't teach just Montana law. They'd use these national casebooks, and then they could supplement it with Montana law or something unique. So he went back and taught there, and Russell Niles wanted to keep him there, to be the foremost expert in the United States on the Uniform Commercial Code. Well, David, I saw him in December at a meeting, a hiring meeting of law teachers. And he said, well, he and Helen had talked about it, and they really wanted to come back to Missoula. And I said, well, that'd be great. He said, well, I want to come back. And he said, I'm not mad about not being dean and so forth, you know. Well, hell, he was my biggest supporter. People would come to him and say, well, who the hell is that damn Sullivan doing now? And David would say, give him a chance, you know. So, anyway, here we roll around to 1978. I'm dean, you know, since 55. And so I'm pushing, you know, as much as I can for the law school. Our salaries were not as high as they should be, and the legislature sometimes, God, I remember one year that my salary increase was $50 for for the year, you know. And so it so I was pushing, you know. And then these were in the transition years when we were moving from beginnings and the post-2-World War crush of people coming back into the beginning of a graduate professional school. And so I was making some people mad, you know, with saying, all right, now we're different, you know. Well, there wasn't any graduate school. They had a name and an office over in Main Hall. But the people that taught graduate courses also taught undergraduate courses. So there wasn't really, there was the concept, but it really was not fleshed out. It wasn't like pharmacy, which now has doctoral program, mm-hmm. you know, and history, okay? So anyway, Carl put the budget together and went over and presented it. And it had some pretty good salary increase recommendations for faculty. I'm not talking just about law faculty, university faculty. Well, the board was resistant, you know. And one of them said, now these are lay people, you know, most of them. And one of them said, well, if you want to do that, why don't you go back and lay off all of those non-tenured people and take that money and you can give the salary increases you want. Carl said, I'd resign first. He got up and stomped out. Well, he'd been there alone, and on the way back, he thought he was a little bit hasty. So he called, and he said, called over and said, well, no, I didn't resign. They said, well, we consider it a resignation, and we're going to have a meeting, and we'll call you over to talk about it. So a couple of weeks later, he asked Bob Panzer and I to go with him to Helena. And we were there and at the meeting, and he made his presentation and everything else. And they said, well, the three of you are excused while we deliberate this. So we went into the Attorney General's office, which is right next door to the conference room. And we were sitting there talking, and Forrest Anderson, who was the Attorney General, who later on became the governor of the state, he walks in the door and he says, well, that's the way the ball bounces. You're done. Well, hell, we were stunned, and we came back, and lots of celebrating among a lot of faculty here who hated McFarland's guts. I've already given to the university copies of the newspaper and the Kaiman containing three letters, one written by Leif Erikson, who was very powerful in the Democratic Party, one by a student who wanted an explanation of what went on, you know, and why this was done. And one by somebody else. And Forrest Anderson's reply was, well, if all we had to do was sit around and listen to complaints, we'd get nothing done. This doesn't even merit talking about. So, Carl came back and the Board of Education appointed Gordon Castle as the acting president. Well, the interesting thing was that Subsequently, Gordon Castle came over to meet with the Board of Education about the budget. They approved the budget that Carl had recommended in the first instance. You know? So Gordon served for about a year and a half, I think. Now, I'm kind of out of context with this, but I mentioned to you earlier that one of the things that the law school provide lots of services within the university, outside the university. And a federal district judge, a lawyer, graduate of this law school, William Jameson, partner in a big law firm in Billings, Montana. And he had been for years a member of an organization called the Uniform Laws Conference that was formed in 1882. You know, the Federal Constitution, and I'm not quoting verbatim, has a provision that the powers not given to the federal government are reserved to the states. Okay? So this organization was formed to step into the gap, and they wanted to do a uniform law on marriage and divorce, but they never got that done until decades later. But anyway, this organization was formed called the Uniform Laws Conference. Yeah. It's a organization of lawyers, practicing lawyers, law teachers, government officials. And Bill Jameson had been the only... there were three commissioners over the years, but when he was on there, he was the only one. And he was nominated to be a federal district judge for Eastern Montana. Well, the interesting thing about all of that was that there was a sitting federal district judge for Eastern Montana by the name of Charles N. Pray, P-R-A-Y. Well, Charles Pray had been educated at the University of Chicago, and he'd been a county attorney up in Fort Benton when there were only very few counties in Montana. And at one time, he had about 18 people on death row that he had convicted, you know. Well, he was elected to Congress. He was the person that put in the legislation that formed Glacier National Park. And was appointed federal district judge by Calvin Coolidge. And that was back in the 1920s, okay? When I came out in 1954, he was still serving, you know? And in fact, he served until Eisenhower was elected president, because he was going to wait till the Republican was elected, and hell, he was in his 90s. Well, Bill Jameson was nominated to succeed him. And Bill Jameson wrote to the governor, Hugo Aronson, and said, "Now, this Uniform Laws Conference, explained what it was, how important it was, and how Montana had relied on it in many ways in adopting uniform laws." He said, "I think that you ought to have a broad-based commission in Montana. You should have the Chief Justice of the Montana Supreme Court. You should have a lawyer who is also a legislator. And you should have the dean of the law school." Well, Governor Aronson, in 1957, appointed the three of us as Uniform Laws Conference members. Now, Getting back to Carl McFarland, he was terminated in 1958, okay? Well, before termination, maybe it was his last official act, he had a legal secretary who had been with him for 25 years, by the name of Gwen Folsom, and he transferred her budget line from the president's office to the law school. So we had her for a year, 58 and 59. And she was brilliant. She worked with David Mason, and they prepared the Uniform Commercial Code for introduction in the state of Montana. Now, I had enough money to... now, those were the days when if you wanted more than one copy of something, you know, you would use a stencil, blue, you know, and so you'd type it, you know, and if it was a mistake, it was a hell of a deal trying to correct the stencil. Well, she did all the research, read the whole all Montana law from the Constitution all the way through. The law, check with David Mason if there's something where it was different. And I knew a law commissioner from University of Chicago, Soya Metchnikoff, whose husband had been the drafter of this commercial code. Well, anyway, she prepared it and ran off 150 copies, one for each legislator. It was that thick. And the legislative rule at that time was that if you're going to amend a existing state law, that there'd be something in the existing law you had to delete. Well, what you would do, you would print the bill, you'd come to the matter to be deleted, you put parenthesis, delete. Close parenthesis, not even mention what it was, and pick it up again. So she did that in this draft. Well, we had it all wired to pass, but it was so damn thick, it would have used up the whole printing budget of the Business and Industry Committee. So I said, well, we'll get it done the next time. So I went back and grabbed a few copies of it and had some when the next... session came. Well, the legislature changed the rule, and they said, "No, you can't just have omitted. You got to print and then strike through the part omitted." Well, Gwen Folsom was long gone by the time this session started, and I didn't have any money to do it, you know. And so, Dan Dykstra, trust officer with the then Union Bank and Trust Company, was the chair of the Business Industry Committee, and he was able to get unanimous consent of the legislature to waive the rule for this code. And so that's how we got it passed. So what I'm trying to say with all this verbiage, you know, that Carl McFarland was a brilliant man, and he was... he was done a dirty damn trick, you know, by the Board of Education. And there are... I've talked about this a little bit in more detail in a oral history I've done for the law school on my 25 years there that I have said cannot be made public until after I die. I've kind of skipped around a little bit, but and Carl, among other things, you know about building fees. Well, he was a great user of building fees. And among other things, he said, you know, the students ought to have something to do besides go to school. They need some recreation. And so... they built the built the swimming pool, built the ice rink with student building fees. They didn't take care of the ice rink, and that went down the tubes. But then he looked at the dorms along Maurice Avenue there, and he said, you know, the utilities are all in there, so why don't we just join them? That'll give a few more rooms. Well, it's not an architectural thing of beauty, but that's how it happened, you know. Mm-hmm. So, is that enough of that general question?
Yeah, you know, you haven't mentioned where the law school was in the time you came, and also along the lines of just physically where it was, you know, something that I've often heard about the law school is how sort of insular it is compared to other departments on campus. And I guess I'd like you to speak to that a little bit. Was that the case when you came? Has it always been so? Why so?
Well, it was it had a transient existence space-wise.
Mm-hmm.
It was up in Main Hall at one time, and I've mentioned that when I came in 54, it was on the Oval, in that building that has the big granite spires, you know. And Carl McFarland said to me, he said, you need a new law building. So I wrote to one of our accrediting agencies, the Association of American Law Schools. They had a whole file of stuff. So I got a copies of them and looked at them. And the one at the University of Wyoming looked, you know, like it was interesting. So I got the faculty involved and sent over a plan for a law building. He sent it back. He said, too small. Got to be bigger. Well, that was in probably 1956 or so, and I never heard from him after that, and of course he went by the tubes, you know. Then one of the presidents was a man by the name of Harry Newbern. He had been president of the University of Oregon. Oregon had a law school, so he knew what law schools were and how they fit into the scheme of things. So when he came, he wrote a memo to each of the deans, said, I want you to tell me what is your highest priority. Well, I went to my files and I took out the memo to Martin McFarland and changed a few names and sent it over. Well, there were enough unused building fees at the time that he authorized in addition to the Board of Education building, and authorized the building of the law school. And so the law school, we moved in there in 1961, and it was located across from the music building, and at that time that whole block was all residences, and it's across from the health service and across from the music building. But while Martin McFarland is still here, he was a great visionary. And he said to me one time, he said, you know, he said, the concept of Inns of Court in London, that's where they teach lawyers to be lawyers. And what they are, they're living quarters. And where the lawyers to be live. And then they have practicing lawyers that come in, and they'll eat and they'll teach, you know. He said, there's a house down here, he said, that is on the market. That would be a great Inns of Court house. Well, it's the president's house. And it had been built by a man by the name of Linus, who was a mathematical professor and who developed workbooks, you know, for arithmetic. And then and the royalties from that built the house. And most of the stuff in there is imported from Europe, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, he sold it. Was bought by a doctor named Preston, who lived in his butterfly house up here. Well, he found that it was more than he could chew. So there was some talk about a mortuary being interested in it. Well, the people in that area weren't too interested in having a mortuary there. So Carl bought it for the university. And it became a residence for single law students. And I was about 18 of them. And then we had memberships that we asked lawyers and judges and visiting dignitaries to come down and have dinner, you know, with the students and visit with them about things. Well, that lasted about 3 or 4 years. And then we got to a point where there weren't that many single law students. And so Carl sold it to the Diocese of Helena for a Newman House. For single Catholic students. With a proviso that if it would ever be sold, that Montana University would have the first crack at it. Well, then they built the Newman building, you know, catty corner from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't just economically feasible, so the university bought it, and it's been the president's house ever since. So, but I say, now, when we built the law building, the new law building, Harry Newbern said, you know, he said, you're going to have to a hard choice to make. He said, pardon me for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Let me slip over into something else. Still talking about the law building. There was enough money to build the building. And it's an interesting building. The architect was Bill Fox, long since dead. But the contractor also had the contract on the education building. And this is the first time that he had used precast concrete for construction. And so they call them channels, and they're about this wide. And maybe from here to the door over there.
And what would you say, 20 feet?
Yeah.
Three feet by 20 feet?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of come down so that they got legs, you know, they got the whole length on each side. So they brought those things in. And that's the floor of the law building. That's the second story of the law building. That's the roof of the law building. And so it went up pretty darn fast.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a board of visitors to the law, so that's another thing that Carl said. He said, you ought to have an advisory board, independent of the president of the University of Montana. So I got Republicans and Democrats and big firms, small firms, alumni, non-alumni. And they'd come in and I'd bare my soul to them, you know. I'd tell them, look, what's going on and so forth. Well, there was a time under a president by the name of Bowers. He came in to be interviewed, and I think a law faculty member was in one of the interview sessions, and gave a glowing report, you know, of, you know, well, his background and all. Well, then he met with some of the people that didn't have any great love for me, and they said, "You got to put Sullivan back in his cage," you know. So our relations were cordial, but it came down to the point where accreditation entered into the picture. Now, we're accredited by the American Bar Association, Association of American Law Schools. And the American Bar comes in and visits periodically. Was it every 5 years? Well, the first time we were accredited, when I came here, was in 1957. So that was 3 years after I came. Now, when I came, the entire university, except for the School of Mines and Beauty, was on the quarter system. I'm a semester guy. So, one of the things that we did right off the bat was to look at the curriculum. And law courses, there's one examination, it costs 100%. In the second year of law study, they were taking 6 courses twice a week, you know. And the exam was in June, you know. Well, I didn't think that was very pedagogically sound, you know. And so we were talking about what could we do to collapse some of these courses. And David Mason, God rest his soul, said, "Well, what you want to do, you can do with a semester system." And that's how the semester system was born for the law school. And so we developed the curriculum, turned everything upside down. We came up with a curriculum where everything in the first year is required, everything in the second year is required, and all but about 10 hours in the third year required. Diploma privilege, okay? We were the admitting authority. And so our objective was not to educate lawyers about Montana law, but our objective was to provide an education where they could practice law any place, okay? But we were educating for the practice of law. And that meant that they, when I came, quarter system, well, I'm not blaming it all on that, but when I came, you know, classes were Monday through Friday, and some of them were clustered, so you'd have all your classes in the morning and in the afternoon. Sometimes you'd go to class, sometimes you wouldn't. Okay. Here we got all these required classes, and I made out the schedule. And, of course, semester system, 3-3, you know, you'd have Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. So we had Saturday morning classes. I taught a Saturday morning class. I figured, well, if they're going to have to do it, I'm going to do it. Then we always had an interval between classes. So classes would go from 8 to 9, 10 to 11, 1 to 2. So once we got them there, you know, we figured they'd stay there and study. Then, under the Accrediting Association regulations, you can't be a full-time student and work 20 hours a week on the outside. So we put that in. And then you have to attend every class. Can't come in the first year, first class, come back and take the exam. Well, you see, that made me very, very popular among the, among the students. But it was part of our responsibility under the diploma privilege, you know. Now, getting back to the Board of Visitors. So when Bowers came, the accrediting said, accrediting board, they were very, in 1957, the examiner described us as a graduate professional school. So that was right up my alley, and I use that phrase a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. But I can't give you a date on Bowers off the top of my head, but we had an accrediting visitation, and he said that we needed more space. We were getting 20 to 200 to 250 students, 75 in the first year class. And so they said you need more space. So I made the pitch to Bowers, and they had already decided at the Board of Regents what the priorities were going to be for buildings. And so the Accrediting Association called Bowers and myself back to the meeting of the council in Philadelphia in February. And said, now, what's going to go on? He explained that it'd be difficult, and didn't know when they could do it. Well, they asked me what I thought, and I said, well, the university's going to decide whether it wants a law school or not. If it wants one, it's going to have to provide with the law what it needs. If not, then graduate the people that are there now, get a witchy kind of arrangement like they have in medicine, you know, so Montana's going to go to law school at Idaho or someplace else out of state, and that the legislature would pick up the difference between out-of-state tuition and in-state tuition. Well, Bowers wasn't very happy with me. We came back, and he met with the Board of Visitors. And the Board of Visitors really put the squeeze on him, you know. And he says, well, there's nothing I can do. Well, then they got busy. They buttoned all the legislators and others, you know. And so they got it on the agenda, and the legislature approved it, but without any money, okay? So they approved a building for $1,400,000 or something, but no money. So if we wanted a building, we had to raise the money. And so fortunately, Montana, parts of Montana are an area of low employment, and Missoula is one of the areas. And so we, through the governor's office, we were able to get $900,000 towards the $1.4 million. Then we set up our own fundraising outfit, and we raised the rest of it. But the Board of Visitors were very adamant in terms of, you know, this had to be done, and we'll do all we can do to help it. I skipped across several things. Have I missed anything?
Well, you know, you made me think about your statement earlier about how Carl McFarlane came and saw this as a good university and wanted to make it a great university. How about yourself as a long-term dean of a law school? I mean, you've already mentioned number of changes that happened in the time you were there. What was your, if you had one, overall vision or direction for the law school? You know, you've mentioned that things changed to a graduate professional school. You got a new building and funding for that. You've talked about accreditation. Your sort of change in teaching methodology from to the problem-based teaching, a move to semester system. What if you can encapsulate it in sort of a grand vision or direction that you were leading the law school?
Well, in lots of ways, I had the best law school dean's job in the United States. After a while, I was able to get authorization for an assistant dean. Until then, I used to do everything. I used to admit people, and I was the administrator. But I could teach, and I did a little bit of writing. I got deeply involved in continuing legal education as an aide to the Bar Association, but then continuing legal education of lawyers or alumni. And and we had programs, Clee and Ski up at Whitefish, that brought in a lot of money that we could hold conferences over in Miles City or someplace where only 5 or 6 people would show up, you know. But it was self-sufficient. The law school planned it, funded it, and so and then as circumstances developed, there were things going, there was ferment going on in Montana at the judicial branch. Supreme Court authorized the commission to adopt the federal rules of civil procedure for Montana courts. And David Mason, one of our faculty members, was on that. then through the Uniform Laws Conference, we got the Uniform Commercial Code passed. And then we, conference commissioners, what do we undo? Conference meet every year, 10 days, and the three of us get together and we look through the list of things that we had not passed, and we'd identify some, and I'd go back to my faculty and see if there was a faculty member be interested in doing some of the background research and so forth. And so there was just a huge explosion in the legislature, bringing Montana laws up to date from what was known as the Field Civil Code, which Montana adopted in toto at the time it became a state. It was developed by a man named Field in New York, for New York. New York never passed it, but California did. And so Montana picked that up, you know, almost in toto. I remember there was one act that Montana was the only state that did not pass it. And it was an act to simplify the transfer of stock ownership when there had been a death. Okay. And so a telephone company in Denver sent people up here to testify for it, and I testified for it. And the assistant head of the Business and Industry Committee was a non-lawyer. He was an oil man from Billings. And so I explained the act, you know. And the act had the name, a Uniform Act for the Simplification of Security Interest Transfers. And I got done. He said, "Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dykstra," he said, "I must confess that I was confused before I heard Dean Sullivan's explanation, but now I'm confused on a much higher plane. But, you know, the legislature, there was a lot of trust there, you see. They accepted the Uniform Commercial Code, they accepted other things, Uniform Probate Code, working with a state bar association. There was a lot of trust that people didn't have an axe to grind, and this was for improvement and so forth. Now, there were other things that we got into. Duke Crowley, God love him, is retired from the law school, but he still volunteers there. He had been first assistant attorney general under Forrest Anderson when Anderson was the attorney general. Well, Anderson became governor, and in 1969 he asked, if Duke was a member of the law faculty, he asked if he could borrow Duke to read the bills coming out of the legislature and advise him what ought to be signed, what didn't. So Duke went over, and then there was a lot of interest in reformation of the executive branch. And there was some federal money available. And so they got the federal money, and Anderson appointed Duke to be the coordinator of a revision of the entire executive branch. There had been over 100 agencies, and Duke reduced them to 18 and was adopted by the legislature. So this was just a huge, huge accomplishment that we got into kind of by reason of the fact that Duke was on the faculty, you know. I guess what I'm trying to say, and I'm probably leaving out a lot, I looked upon the law school as a responsibility to train people for the practice of law.
Mm-hmm.
And the diploma privilege gave us all kinds of responsibilities. And people said I was always defending it. Well, I wasn't defending it. I was trying to live up to the responsibilities we had under it. And so one of the offshoots of it was, now, they would sign this notarized statement when they applied, bring it up to date at the start of the second year, bring it up to date at the start of the third year, and bring it up to date the week before they were going to go over to be sworn in. But there was no inquiry into moral character and fitness at all. And so I talked to Carl McFarland, and I said, you know, we ought to take a look at this. There ought to be. And so I looked around, got all kinds of ideas, and put together this 18-page moral character and fitness questionnaire, which everybody had to fill out. We had one instance where a young man, where we printed the oath that a lawyer would have to take. And he said to me, he said, I'm a Quaker, you know, I don't believe in oaths. So I contacted the Chief Justice. The Chief Justice says, that's okay, just have him affirm, you know. So, but maybe I've said this before, we turned down several people. One because he lied to us, but that was, we put that in because it was a part of our responsibility, it seemed to me, in terms of not only adequate academic preparation, but also if there was something that may militate against admission, it ought to be known right up front. I don't know that I can safely put all this stuff together. We were very active in continuing real education, as I said, and active in the unification of the bar in 1975. But we raised the money for the new building. There were limitations in terms of time, and this $900,000 from the federal government. And we were really on a fast track to meet those conditions. And so we set up a fundraising operation within the law school, a couple of people here at the university that had experience. We borrowed them. And as it turned out, we raised enough money to not only build the building, but also to buy all new furniture for the building. And this doesn't have any relevance to the university, and probably sounds like I'm tooting my own horn, but we had an extensive clinical training program in the law school, and it all started in 1966. called the Montana Defender Project. Bill Jamison told us about it. He had a friend with him, a retired Army general by the name of Decker, D-E-C-K-E-R, who was administering a huge Ford Foundation grant to improve clinical training in law schools. Well, we applied and we got a grant. It was ongoing. It wasn't just for a year. And what we did, it was earmarked for Indian and non-Indian to provide defense in criminal cases. And it covered eastern Montana. It was a summer program. So we had students all over the place in eastern Montana. And then during the academic year, we had all kinds of students involved in going over to the prison and talking to prisoners who want to have their sentence or forth reviewed. And then we set up in the law school for seniors a kind of a legal aid thing, you know, where people would walk in. And then with the Department of Justice, we were able to set up a summer program where law students would work with county attorneys all during the summer. And then we had what do we call the criminal law research information center, where we would have a faculty member at the law school would supervise students. And if a county attorney would have a would want some research done, you know, some of them, they may be the only lawyer in the county, you know, and they didn't have time to do it, didn't have the library in the first place. Well, they'd write in and say, here's the problem. And so we'd have the law student and the supervision of the law faculty member do the research and kind of balance the the defense against the prosecution. But these things all kind of they were kind of interruptions, in a way, you know. I use the term, the terms I used with you before, you know, mm-hmm. that a lot of these things we didn't plan, and there it was, and so we took the ball and ran with it.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back on it, I think that I've got there's a lot of joy in working with young people, and in having a sense that the wholeness of the law school, its beginnings, its gradual professional structure, its law-centeredness, that all of these things made a significant difference in the growth and improvement of the law.
Mm-hmm. So with that assessment of your time and, you know, your career there, what about looking at it now? I mean, you can virtually look at the school from your north-facing windows here where you live, mm-hmm. and I know before we started our interview here, you mentioned having read a recent article about the goings-on at the university, so I assume that you keep abreast of things there.
Yeah.
To whatever degree you do keep abreast of them, what is your assessment of the law school and the university now?
Well, my intention is never to look back, in the sense, that's not the right way to say it. My intent is never to try to hang on, you know, that when you're done, you're done. And so, when I went to work for Montana Power Company after I retired, I never came back to law school. I believe that the person who was in the position of dean should structure what he saw as necessary and so forth. In other words, I didn't try to hang on as though what I did was the best and it shouldn't be changed. I've got a lot of admiration for Ed Eck as the dean. Tough job. And I think that some notoriety connected with Nielsen, you know, which is kind of unfortunate, I think. But it's a damn fine law school. And I think it's recognized nationally as one of the leaders in terms of hands-on clinical experience and training. And they work hard at it, and they do a great job of being able to find the wherewithal to get the things done. When I was there, I was in sometimes just a one-way dialogue with people, particularly in the liberal arts faculty, who quarreled about accreditation, didn't know what it was, but now, you know, it's by the board, and accreditation has been been great leverage in terms of getting things done. I don't have any misgivings, I don't think, and I don't have any animosities. So I think that as a fine law school is recognized as being preeminent in several things they do, and and they're involved in all kinds of research projects, and they've got a very good faculty. So I can't, there probably are other things that I maybe haven't even mentioned or glossed over, but I think that probably hits it.
Great. Well, I appreciate your time.
Oh, I appreciate talking to you.
Yeah.
So is there anything else you want to talk about?
I think that about wraps it up for me.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.